From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, the state of heart research. We'll speak with a Milwaukee cardiologist, the president-elect of the American Heart Association.
Then why a group of Parkinson's disease patients is gathering in a boxing gym in West Allis.
We'll work on footwork, we'll work on hand-eye coordination, speed of movement, all the things you would see in a regular boxer we're taking on, and it's just happens to be people with Parkinson's that are doing these exercises.
We'll talk about why the disappearance of small farms around the country should be of concern to people in both rural and urban America.
I'm really concerned about the countryside and rural communities, because how is that ever going to transfer to the next generation? And that's a real question that I think we need to ask ourselves when we think longer term.
And we'll listen back to a song recorded in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Last week, some of us at WUWM had the chance to take a refresher course on cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR, and learn how to use the automated external defibrillator, or AED, device in our offices.
The goal from that training is to have as many people as possible ready to assist in the case of a heart emergency. And that's music to the ears of Dr. Ivor Benjamin. Benjamin is the director of the Cardiovascular Center at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and in July, he'll assume the role of president of the American Heart Association.
Dr. Benjamin stopped by the Lake Effect studio recently to talk about the state of heart research and the importance of his new role. Thanks so much for taking a few minutes to talk. Welcome to the program.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
What made you want to go into this field?
Well, I began to think about becoming a physician in high school, particularly because my grandmother, in fact, had a medical condition. And it had quite a significant impact on me. And, of course, as a young man being interested in math and the sciences, medicine was not a straightforward logical choice, but it happened to work out.
Well, and it's a profession that will always be needed. Was cardiology what you were interested in to begin with?
I would say I leaned towards cardiology very early on. I was obviously interested in how the heart works and how it's connected to blood vessels. And I began to get some appreciation that a condition called hypertension, for example, of course, has significant consequences on the heart. So it was just a nice blend. And I think that, of course, heart attacks are quite prevalent, both here in the United States and across the world. And there were many exciting advances that were happening in cardiology when I began my medical training.
So that's right. I was going to ask you, if you think about the continuum of cardiology since you began your training to where we are now, what were the kinds of issues that you were most commonly working on at the beginning of your work? And how far do you think we've come in the context of understanding how the heart works and understanding how we can make patients, help patients lead better lives?
Well, Mitch, it's really been an absolutely phenomenal 25 years, 30 years that we've been able to witness not only advances in cardiovascular sciences and cardiovascular medicine. When I began medical school, and in fact when I was just a medical resident, those new agents that we call clot busters were just coming on the market. Today we know that we, of course, have angioplasties, and there are even advances today where one is able to replace a diseased valve that is quite narrowed without open-heart surgery. That procedure is called transaortic valve replacement, where the replacement valve is introduced at the tip of a catheter. It's absolutely phenomenal in terms of what we're able to do.
And presumably the risks to the patient are much less the less you have to cut them open.
Oh, absolutely. And what that therefore also means is that many more high-risk patients can actually be the beneficiaries of these technologies. And so in addition to technologies, which is obviously a space where cardiologists tend to be known for, we also have phenomenal medications. There have been research that have been very successful to know what are the kinds of optimal medications even after someone has a heart attack, and not to mention the fact, of course, we know about cholesterol, and there are significant advances in that space as well.
What about public health measures? There are advances in techniques, advances in medication, but what about public health measures? You know, it has not been all that long ago in this country where, you know, people could smoke on airplanes. The smoking rates among young people were especially high. Talk about where public health meets what you do in the field of cardiology.
Well, I think that this is really the central question of the day. What I like to say as a cardiologist, I would have to put myself out of business. And one way that you can do that is obviously to prevent. We very well know that caring for patients with heart conditions is very expensive. I absolutely want to get the word out that if you have a medical condition, particularly a medical condition related to your heart, absolutely go ahead and get that out. Of course, we've done phenomenal things with 911 and really being able to show how we can improve, for example, health outcomes, as you mentioned earlier, around CPR. These are absolutely critically important things. But I really think that really being able to promote prevention of heart disease, and we know what those are, an appropriate diet, exercise, managing one's cholesterol, obviously being able to address blood pressure, as well as, of course, really being able to address things like diabetes. These are all the key and critically important things that we have to be able to do to be able to prevent. And as you know, prevention is better than cure.
Well, and so in the course of trying to do this, do you see particular communities as having especially acute needs for this?
Oh, without a doubt. I think that we very well know that just in the city of Milwaukee, there are significant differences in terms of health disparities. And many of those are preventable conditions related to hypertension, which, of course, has a disproportionate impact in the African-American community, others that have to be impacted by diabetes. And it's just as important that we talk about the heart, and I can also want to slip in there that many of these lifestyle interventions that we can take actually will probably be able to contribute to having better cognitive function. We don't have the direct science to support that, but certainly I think that clearly there are aspects to cardiology and certain types of cardiovascular disease, such as atrial fibrillation, where one of the complications is, of course, to be able to have these embolic strokes.
Right. You're talking about blood flow to the brain here. And clearly, if blood flow to the brain is cut off, there are negative consequences.
There are clearly negative consequences. So these are all actually things that we think are super important. Last but not least, of course, to include in there, of course, if someone is smoking. Certainly quit smoking and really being able, again, to really reap the phenomenal benefits that we have at this point in time in human history through prevention.
So when you think about where medicine was when you began to practice and where it is today, how much more likely is someone with a heart condition or an acute heart issue to survive today than they were when you began practicing?
Oh, I mean, this is so the single most important thing, of course, is to have as many citizens who are able to do high quality cardiopulmonary resuscitation. This is mission critical. It should be an opportunity that everyone should be able to be trained and to be able to do. But you have to be able to do high-quality CPR. But certainly, if the person then is able to have the tremendous rapid response system that we have here in the city of Milwaukee, they can go to any of our area hospitals, obviously, Frederick to the Medical College of Wisconsin. I'm a little bit biased in that regard. But we know that one should be able to survive a heart attack. I think it's a real shame that especially someone even in their youth should really be able to succumb to a heart attack. So we should be able to eliminate that. And again, it's because we have to really be able to provide. coupled with that, even after someone has a heart attack, we know there are medications. There are many devices that are able to prevent the kinds of life-threatening arrhythmias that can sometimes – and so obviously the implantation of defibrillators has tremendously been able to reduce the kind of mortality and improve survival. And last but not least, we've got these amazing devices. They're called left ventricular devices, which might be a bridge towards transplantation. We know that when someone, for example, has a defective heart, that the number of transplants have not increased in this country over the last decade. So technology actually seems to be, if you will, the default pathway or the backup for us to really be able to continue to reap these remarkable benefits that we have.
What do you think the opportunity to be the that you will soon be the president of the American Heart Association? What does that opportunity afford you?
Well, first of all, it's a phenomenal personal privilege and honor. And it's a recognition by my peers and by an organization that I like to say walks the talk. We know that the American Heart Association is absolutely committed to really being in the space of public policy. We need to be able to do the kinds of things that individuals themselves are not able to do. Of course, educating people about really being able to – on the risk factors for cardiovascular disease and stroke. And just as well, I think that really being able to be in the space where we're able to take young people and engage them in a way. I mentioned a little bit about heart health, but we also need to be thinking about brain health. These are all conditions that actually will accrue over decades. But if you can engage people very early on, then obviously we hope that they can have healthy, successful, and very lives that are for not only for themselves but their families as well.
There is something of an ambassadorial role that the president plays during his tenure in that position. Does that make it more difficult to for you to actually practice medicine here in Milwaukee?
Well, I would say that, of course, if I'm across, you know, somewhere across the world, being able to promote cardiovascular health, I actually think that that actually reflects positively that right here at the Medical College of Wisconsin, we're an academic medical center. In its midst are leaders who are selected and chosen to be ambassadors, as you said. And so being the chief medical and science officer for the American Heart Association, it's an honor that I carry. But it's not just for myself, but it's for all my other colleagues and friends who are back home doing life-saving work.
Do you think – is there an inspirational role that you play as well?
Well, if in some small measure the fact that I may be able to go to any part of the world and they can see someone somebody of color really being able to rise to this particular position, and if there is some way that I may represent a mentor, then that's fine. But I think more importantly, it's that commitment that cardiovascular disease and stroke are preventable diseases. I think that one to be able to communicate to broad audiences, both nationally and globally, about the kinds of things that we can be able to do to eliminate those diseases, I think are quite important for all of us. And I think it's a real privilege to have that opportunity.
Well, Dr. Ivor Benjamin, congratulations on the new role and best of luck in your work.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to.
Dr. Ivor Benjamin is the president-elect of the American Heart Association. He's a professor and director of the Cardiovascular Center at Froedtert and the Medical College of Wisconsin.
Dr. Benjamin talked about his interest in broader health concerns than just cardiology. We will turn next to efforts to help Parkinson's patients manage the symptoms of their disease in a unique way. That's when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Parkinson's disease is a degenerative neurological condition that, over time, causes patients to lose muscle and body control. It can start out as something as simple as a limp, progress to tremors, and can eventually leave a patient entirely incapacitated.
While doctors and hospitals can offer medications, surgery, and physical therapy, some patients are looking for a support group environment with others who see Parkinson's as just one part of their lives. And in one group, they're fighting to stave the disease off with a punching bag.
On this month's Fit for You, Audrey Nowakowski takes us to Rocksteady Boxing in West Allis, where the group of boxers all have Parkinson's and are exercising to improve their lives.
Bionic Woman, Rockin' Rabbi, The Enforcer. These are just some of the names of boxers who meet several times a week at a West Allis gym. What makes this group of fighters unique is that not only are they honing their skills, they're also fighting Parkinson's disease. For this month's Fit for You, I joined a group of fighters for a class at Rocksteady Boxing to learn more. Today's class involved pairing up and moving to different stations for 1 minute at a time. The fighters did everything from hula hoops, jump rope, push-ups, burpees, bouncing medicine balls, and driving their knees into a punching bag.
Okay, here we go. 1 minute. Ready, set, and go!
And of course, we can't forget what they love the most. Punching things.
All right, first two up. Face the bag.
Loud.
Ready, set, and go.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, loud. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Bamba, let's choose loud.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
That's what I'm talking about.
Class participants range in age and physical abilities, but they all come full force in support of one another to fight against Parkinson's. Fast Forward Fitness owner Daryl Jack and Cricket Green join me after class to talk about the program that has changed their lives. Jack starts by explaining the connection between boxing and Parkinson's.
A number of years ago, of 60 different sports, and determined that boxing, by degree of difficulty, was the top out of 60 sports. So what we do know as far as Parkinson's is concerned is that forced intense exercise, basically just restating that, is exercising beyond a volunteer rate, is sort of the sweet spot for helping stop the progression of Parkinson's in a lot of cases. So that if we know that the boxing training is the most intense form, and we know that forced intense exercise is a boon to people with Parkinson's disease, then we know that the marriage of those two are a good fit.
Can you clarify a little bit what it is to go beyond a volunteer rate?
Absolutely. So basically, a volunteer rate is anything that you do where you sort of feel comfortable, you can hold easy conversation, and you can do that in typically about the point where you want to say, okay, enough is enough, I want to stop, I want to quit. That's where we keep going. That's where we go beyond the volunteer rate.
Can you explain what Parkinson's does to the body and how boxing exercises help to slow that progression?
Yes. So Parkinson's is a neurodegenerative disease where certain dopamine-stimulating cells, producing cells in the brain, in a region of the brain, die off. Once those cells die off, the neurons start to fire erratically, making it very hard or sometimes impossible for a person to direct or control their body functions. That can mean, slowness of movement. It can mean postural instability, which has to deal with balance and coordination. There can often be tremors, I think, which is most times associated with Parkinson's disease, the lowering of the voice. There's a whole host of symptoms that kind of come along with that.
So, Cricket, when did you first get diagnosed with Parkinson's, and what did you know at the time to even be able to deal with the disease or combat it?
I was in my 30s when I was diagnosed, and that's young for a person. And they thought I started limping with my leg. And I went to many doctors, many medications, and had an MRI done, and they told me I had Parkinson's.
What went through your brain at that first diagnosis?
They give you this book and tell you everything you wanted to know about Parkinson's, but they make you feel you're going to be like a vegetable. So it was really scary finding out.
Did you feel like there was much hope to live a quality life or prolong it before you just got this information about an eventual vegetative state?
No.
So when did you first come to this gym to start boxing?
About 16 months ago.
And what have you found that it's done for you since you started the program?
Balance, and you get to act like a little kid and have fun. And the coaches are awesome and wakes you up.
Before coming to boxing, did you have any other group environments with other people who are also dealing with their Parkinson's disease?
No, I was going to go to support groups, but I didn't want to go because they showed the worst people in wheelchairs and drooling, and I didn't want to be more depressed.
You mentioned here you can be a little kid. You all can have fun together. So how important is it for you from diagnosis to now to keep exercise as an important part of your life? Was it essential before?
Yeah. I used to be in aerobics and used to walk around gyms and stuff, but now I do this every day. My boxing exercises and my physical therapy, and I ride the bike for 30 minutes every day, and I lift weights.
Now, Daryl, what were you doing before you discovered this boxing curriculum for PD, and what drew you to it?
So I've owned Fast Forward Fitness for about 10 years now, and I really specialized in weight loss. So I was predominantly doing that, and just by sort of happenstance, I had a sort of mutual friend of a friend who was diagnosed fairly early on with Parkinson's disease, and I was passed a piece through YouTube about this boxing program that was helping people with Parkinson's disease, and I was instantly drawn to that. I had also been doing, I've been a certified kickboxing instructor, so I'd been using a lot of those principles, so this had really caught my eye, and within 2 weeks I was down in Indianapolis getting certified to become certified for Rocksteady Boxing.
Now, the class I just observed, it was so much more than just boxing. In fact, they didn't even put on the gloves until the last portion of the class. So what are you incorporating into your classes, and what does it do for the body for people dealing with Parkinson's?
So basically what you would typically see in a regular fighter's training regimen, somebody who's training to become a professional fighter, you're going to see a lot of those, many of those aspects in what we do on a day-to-day. So we'll work on core exercises. We'll work on footwork, we'll work on hand-eye coordination, speed of movement, all the things you would see in a regular boxer we're taking on, and it's just happens to be people with Parkinson's that are doing these exercises.
So it's never been teaching a boxing class to people with PD, it's simply teaching a boxing class for you?
Absolutely.
With the group camaraderie and people coming together, just like you, Cricket, what do you find that some of your favorite exercises have been that you've been introduced to at Rocksteady?
The hula hoop.
Hula hoop?
Yeah. And the monkey, barrels of monkeys, and jump rope, and hitting the punching bag, and hitting people lightly, gently.
What does it mean to you to have the group here that you see multiple times a week?
Oh, it's awesome. It makes you feel like you're not alone. You're helping other people because you see all kinds of development from severe to not so much, and you complain about it to a person that knows what you're going through. It's hard to tell a person that what we're going through, because you can't tell a person what they can't make you feel it. You can't, if you say I can't get my shoes and socks on, you can't understand that, but it's hard to do.
Having that group and that community here, has it made you view your disease any differently?
Yes, you don't feel so all alone. You have company.
And with this program and these people, I imagine that the curriculum is helping you go beyond what you had. So what have you noticed changed in your body? You mentioned earlier you were once in a wheelchair and had the surgery for correction. But, you know, even mentally, emotionally, how have you felt?
Oh, I crack jokes. I'm funny.
And what else do you do outside of boxing here to keep busy, keep active, stay moving?
Here at the food pantry 4 days a week, and I love it.
And with this gym, Daryl, I'll point this one to you. What's your favorite aspect about teaching this group of people with Parkinson's boxing and having this special energy, this special connection with all of your clients?
There's always this bit of apprehension when people come into this, because most people have never done boxing, and they've certainly never seen themselves ever doing boxing. So they come in here with a lot of apprehension, which is normal. but the things that they're able to accomplish and sort of watching people sort of blossom and flourish in this environment. And some people have really been fairly sedentary throughout their lives, and at this stage where they come in with Parkinson's, needing to be a fighter, how they can really step up to the plate and develop as a person. And you quickly come to find out that these are not a bunch of just disabled people, that they're people who are showing up and they're boxing. They are fighters and they're fighting Parkinson's, and they do so tenaciously.
Cricket, what would you say to someone if they are dealing with a PD diagnosis and don't yet have any support groups, any programs like this? What would you say to convince them to get in the door?
I would say you're going to have a ball. The coaches are awesome, and it'll make you feel better. Your balance, if you fall down, you learn to get up off the floor if you're by yourself, and everything else goes with it.
And what is your favorite part about coming here?
The coaches, they're awesome. They help you if you need help, but they don't overhelp you because you want to do it yourself.
And I imagine, Daryl, that's very important, and part of the training of certification is that you are pushing everyone here within their comfort level, but not, of course, without safety.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the most important things. And one of the biggest challenges we face as coaches is getting the opportunity to take somebody from a point where they don't feel that they can do something and challenging it to prove to themselves that they can do it. And for some reason, if they're not able to do it, we kind of help facilitate them and get them to the point where they can take that first baby step to try it out and see if they can do it. And I would say 9.9 times out of 10, everybody's been able to rise to the occasion.
How do you reflect when you see Cricket today compared to when she first came in your door?
It's amazing the difference, and I got to say one of the best parts about Cricket is she's got an amazing sense of humor. We love her so much for that. She's so funny. She hasn't lost that, but she has gained quite a bit as far as her physical attributes. Her balance is a lot better. She's much stronger. Just her being able to get in and out of a chair, seeing quite a big difference in that, and which is super important, as you heard her speak on sort of being able to do things on your own and keeping your independence, which is the major goal here.
Cricket, how does it affect your life outside of these doors, having this class?
Well, I can only drive to the food pantry. That's all I drive to. I can't walk that far. I hate to say depressing things. You know, I'd rather say I'd be up person. Like the people at the food pantry, I tell them I'm taking boxing, and they, don't hurt me, don't hurt me. And they have different names for me, too. I'm Cricket Wireless at the food pantry. Or Ninja Turtle Princess, they call it. So I have a myriad of names.
Well, and I imagine this class here will help you continue to work at the food pantry, continue to have the independence that you're able to have.
Yes, I like to tell everybody at the food pantry that I love them, and that I'll see them tomorrow, and my boxing friend too, I love him, and I'll see him at boxing.
All right, here we go. We are
For Lake Effect, I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
Daryl Jack and Cricket Crean spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski about Rock Steady Boxing, a program that helps people combat the symptoms of Parkinson's disease. You can learn more and listen to past Fit for You segments at WUWM.com.
Another break, and then we'll shift to farm health with contributor Dave Kozlowski. That's when Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Small farms, whether family-owned or not, represented 46% of production in the United States in 1991. But by 2015, that share had fallen to under 25%, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Among dairy farms in Wisconsin, the numbers are striking. The state topped out at 167,000 dairy farms in 1940 and now has just 9,000.
While the average farm size is growing, the total amount of land in farming has remained the same, and small farms are feeling the pinch as agribusiness dominates. Contributor Dave Kozlowski says this should concern not just farmers and rural residents, but everyone. Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski spoke with Kozlowski, along with cattle farmer Kristen Jersick and dairy farmer Sarah Lloyd, about the alarming state of small farms and why they think things need to shift.
The trend has been big farming. Farms in this state and elsewhere are getting bigger. Small farms are dying. And this is true probably across the board, whether it's poultry, beef, pork, or vegetables for that matter. And the handmaiden, I think, to this process is technology. And there's a lot of gee whiz thinking when this technology comes out. And of course, it's expensive. And the only way you can manage incorporating that technology into your business is to get bigger.
And I think another part of that is what you might call the treadmill of production or the treadmill of technology that people get on, because my husband and I dairy farm with his family. We're three families in the operation. They expanded from 125 cows to 250 in like 2003, and that was to pay for a new milking parlor. And so once you take on that debt, because you don't want to wreck your knees and your body bending down under dairy cows all day long, you then have to like accelerate your production, and then you owe money to the bank, and then you sort of get on that treadmill. And we've had pretty bad markets in a lot of different commodities. Dairy is in a terrible situation right now, but beef has been in bad situations. Corn and soybean farmers are in bad situations. So everybody's kind of just trying to eke out a little bit more production just to keep their heads above water. So part of it is just the pricing and the markets are not supporting family scale agriculture right now. People can't be in business. It doesn't work.
Well, you mentioned that you're a three-family farm, and a lot of farms, whether it's dairy, meat, or produce, are consolidating with each other to survive. And from what I understand, the need for people to do that is ever increasing because you need to be big enough so that you don't fail. Otherwise, you fall off the treadmill, right?
Yeah. And the other thing that I am concerned about is, you know, what are the bankers doing in this? I kind of really look to the credit industry because they're lending money to people to go well past our size, which is 350, to go to 1,000 and 5,000. Even though for dairy, we're in a terribly low price trough, and it doesn't make any sense to me, like from Econ 101, why it would make sense to, when you're losing money in every cow you're milking, how it would make sense to expand, but yet people are getting credit and financing to put these huge capital investments in. And then what happens to those, even if I'm three families or maybe I'm four families, what happens in the next generation when I have $10 million in capital investment in this farm? I'm really concerned about the countryside and rural communities, because how is that ever going to transfer to the next generation? And that's a real question that I think we need to ask ourselves when we think longer term.
What we've seen is we're not reading our history. I mean, this is the same thing that happened in the late 70s and early 80s, which caused the so-called farm crisis of that time. The solutions weren't very good, and we're heading towards another farm crisis.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering was, you know, when were small farms in America last at a comfortable and profitable size and balance? Was there a peak, or has it always been a somewhat tumultuous business?
Probably the 40s and 50s, because then after the war, we started introducing all sorts of technologies that cost money, and to adopt them required farms to change their operation. So while there were still a lot of farms in the 40s, 50s, and 60s that were small and profitable, in part because the markets were there, there was still a lot of direct marketing of product back then. But we were – the writing was on the wall. It was already heading in that direction. With his Errol Butts from the 70s, Get Bigger, Get Out, it was already there.
I mean, it has definitely been a long slog historically. I mean, I even think about our friend fighting Bob La Follette back in the early 1900s. And what was he fighting? He was fighting like railroad monopolies that weren't allowing farmers to access markets and transport their products. And he was working to break that up. So we maybe kind of break it up and then it gets consolidated again. And now we're in this new phase of mega consolidation in all of the sectors of the supply chain, which, again, just isn't allowing farmers to have good, solid markets where they can predict. And then you've also added a lot of volatility in the prices because we aren't regulating that. We aren't really watching how much speculation is going on in the market. And farmers don't have control. They're just price takers for the most part, except for bright spots where people are trying to figure out markets, direct markets. I mean, Organic Valley has been a bright spot in Wisconsin, but it's struggling right now for farmers. But that was where they figured out a market. They could control it from the farmer up to the product, and they could find the consumers that were like, yeah, I'll pay a premium price because I want to support farmers. I want to support cows on grass. I want to support reduced pesticide use. And so you saw that, wow, like, look, we could do this. And Wisconsin has such a great opportunity. We still produce a lot of things in a small and medium scale. And I think now it's now or never really to save it.
Wouldn't it be nice if the farmers in Wisconsin could go down to the Chicago Board of Trade and say, this is what we're asking for our milk.
You know? Yeah.
We're not going to take your price. This is what we want.
Yeah. Yeah, and I do think it's a timely issue because as a small family farm, once all the farms get bigger, our supply chains go away. So we're losing the supply chains that support our small to mid-sized farms as well.
Right.
So.
We've loss of meat processors, loss of the trucking. The people want to pick up the milk or haul the beef. They don't want to go to you if you're too small.
So what I'm wondering is this capitalism or survival of the fittest in the farm world, or is this a result of USDA or government action or inaction that has caused this climate?
Well, I definitely feel that some of the rules that have changed in Wisconsin over the last few years have made it much easier for large confinement farms to be sited in Wisconsin. So I think that's a huge issue.
Drawing parallels on how Walmart impacted rural communities and shutting down small stores, family-owned operations, is big agribusiness the Walmart of the farming industry?
Yes. I'll say it. Yes. you know, and there's something that we're perhaps overlooking a little bit because we're talking about the economics of farming. And as we all know in economics, economists tend to not want to include externalities. One of the problems we're having as we get big is we're losing our sight on how land is treated and how the environment is treated. The other thing is the shadow that is beginning to be cast over all of us, and that's climate change. I just heard a report this morning that they're predicting California temperatures to go up even higher than they have been and to get drier. Now, California is number two in dairy and number one in a lot of produce. We lose California. Are we prepared? Do we have a resilient food system? Do we have a way of bouncing back from that loss of that chain?
Also, I feel like we haven't taken into the socioeconomic cost of our food production. So the issues we're having around the state of Wisconsin with our groundwater and our surface water contamination, and that flushes all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico and the dead zone in the Gulf going out to 25 miles now. So we're not taking those considerations into account at all when we're citing these farms. And it's a huge issue.
Farmers shouldn't be penalized for taking care of the environment. They should actually be paid for taking care of the environment.
Right. And one other aspect that's happening, especially here right outside of Milwaukee, is the buying of land for bigger industries such as Foxconn. So a lot of small farms are on the disappearing end because of industrial agriculture or commercial and residential expansion. So in a world where it's seen that a city's healthy if it is expanding outside of its borders and adding more houses, what is the case to remind people that, no, we need to keep a balance?
I like the word resiliency that you asked. You know, do we have a resilient agriculture? And I think when we think about cities and what their breadbasket is, we would do better. We would have stronger economy, better social relationships, and be thinking about the ecology of the situation if we really looked at kind of micro regions, but then the larger regions, and could really grow a lot of good things in a positive way if we thought about, you know, do we have some redundancy in the system? Like, I want more farms, not fewer farms. We need to really think about redesigning and reimagining the supply chains with a view towards transport, but just building community. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that that's a bright spot in people realizing that they can come together around food. And we have really good food here and really great food culture. So that's, to me, like in all the doom and gloom, like let's really invest in that.
With mm-hmm. developments like this, we also see it with the confinement farms. Mm-hmm. The confinement farms need a place to spread their waste, and so they can pay a lot more for the land than a beginning farmer. So as a farmer, you sort of get into this situation, do I keep farming for a very low margin, or do I just sell my land and be sad about it and move on?
Right. And, you know, you guys would know this better than I would, but the farmers that serve the CAFOs are on contract, right? So they're not necessarily connected to the price of corn or soybean or something that's on the market. They could get a higher price if they needed to.
Yeah, I think in different industries, like dairy versus pork versus, you know, crops, I think it differs to the extent people are on contracts. But that larger economy allows you to forward contract in mm-hmm. ways that even at 350 cows, like my husband and I, we don't have enough milk to play that game. Mm-hmm. And if you go to a 5,000 cow dairy, if you spend more than a day there, you'll see these marketing contracted people coming in about how you should put and call. And, you know, so you're not really connected to the real price. Mm-hmm. And I also speculate that there are probably investment dollars going into large farms in Wisconsin that they don't even care if they're taking a loss, because they may be covering a gain in some other sector and for tax purposes are looking for a loss, which is really sad when you think about how hard farmers work every day to produce good food. And you have this whole other part of the production that doesn't really care what the price is.
Right. And again, even if they care, they only care about the bottom line. They don't care about those externalities that we were talking about before. That's so important to the citizens in this state.
On the note of certain people only caring about the bottom line, farmers have a multitude of their own concerns. Why should urban communities care about this in what is mostly seen as a rural issue, especially if people aren't familiar with where their food is coming from? Because people in a city can go to the store, it's there, they don't think about it.
Well, if they would like to go on vacation around the state and have clean waters to kayak in or canoe in, be able to go to a campground and pump the water out of the well and actually drink the water, be concerned about the health of our states, the health of our citizens, then they should be very concerned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, small farms are more apt to keep wildlife habitat for insects and birds and other critters. People want those birds coming back to their bird feeders in the city. And if unless you have that habitat, they're not going to be coming back because they're not going to exist anymore.
One thing I was also thinking about is that American farming is also so romanticized by the public. You know, throughout time, whether people understand what goes into farming or not, you know, there's always this ideal that people think, no, there should be farms, there should be farmers. But is this romanticism a good or a bad thing when really there's a lack of understanding of what it means to operate a farm nowadays?
I hope that people are still romantic. I'm still romantic, and I shovel some poop every once in a while. Yeah, but people should get it, because I think that the risk is that they look at some things that they don't understand and say, oh, all of that is bad. Because, you know, there are things that go on a farm every day that a person that's never experienced that might not understand and be concerned about. If you just think, you know, things are born on the farm every day, things die on the farm every day. It's a real cycle of life. And the more that we can get people coming out to farms, seeing farms, meeting farmers in the city, that would be a great thing to just continue to expand on. so that they can understand what's going on in the background.
And Sarah, you mentioned earlier that if people and business operations can really decentralize and put that importance back into regional foods truly so that pricing, market value, all those things reflect that, is it the role of the government to do that, or is it the role of consumers to push for this? How do we begin that step?
Yes, both.
It is. Because, I mean, who's the government, right? It's us. And this issue is really an urban issue, not a rural issue, because the city is our marketplace. And unless folks here get concerned about the environmental issues and, quite frankly, some of the health issues of the food that's being produced elsewhere, then nothing's really going to happen because the government's not going to act and markets aren't going to reflect any changes. So the people really need to take an interest in this. We need to get relearned about
local and knowing your farmer and
where
knowing
our
food comes from and how your food is actually raised. There's so many different labels out there that I can see where a consumer would get confused. Over the last 15 years, we went from a few labels on food to a multitude of them. So it's almost hard to navigate that whole labeling chain. But if you actually go out to the farms and meet the farmers and spend time with them and know how they farm, then you'll know how your food is raised and if it's raised in a manner that that's what you want to eat or not.
It's called transparency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I really encourage people to be food citizens. So, you know, you're eating, you're making a political statement with your dollars when you're buying things, but you also have an obligation, whether you live in a city or a rural space, to make sure you're in touch with your state, your county that has a lot to do with land decisions, with your state, with the federal government, and make sure that they understand how important it is to you as a consumer, as an eater. And I encourage people to geek out in the grocery store and look at all the products. Like if you go in the dairy aisle in Wisconsin, look for the 55, which is the inkjet label, because that says that it was processed in Wisconsin. So there's a start. Start looking at your butter packages and your dairy cartons and start to understand where is that actually coming from? How did that get to the farm into my shopping cart and on my table?
Sarah Lloyd is a local dairy farmer and director of development for the Wisconsin Food Hub Cooperative. Kristen Jersik is with Bratzett Family Farm in Jefferson, Wisconsin. And Lake Effect contributor Dave Kozlowski co-owns Pinehold Gardens Farm in Oak Creek.
They spoke with Audrey Nowakowski.
The seasons are especially noticeable when you're a farmer, but they're also something of a metaphor for songwriters. We'll revisit a session recorded in the Lake Effect Performance Studio when Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM now. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. We have a few minutes to listen back to a musical performance recorded in the Lake Effect studio. Nora Jane Struthers grew up in New Jersey, but her sound is very much in keeping with her adopted home of Tennessee.
Regardless of where she's from, Struthers wins lots of fans for her smart lyrics and her musical approach to Americana. She visited with us last fall, right around the release of her latest album called Champion. Here's Nora Jane Struthers and the Party Line with Each Season.
Laying in bed, listen to the sound of you in the kitchen turning beans into brown cream walls, curdling in the morning sun. Thought I was awake to a world in white, something about the kind color of that light tells me spring is come. Winter's warm and summer's snow, wrapped up in this lover's glow. Time is still, I pass right through. Each season just comes down to you.
Nora Jane Struthers and The Party Line and their song Each Season. It was recorded last fall in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. You can hear our interview with them at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.